the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Now, in recent years, TV dramas and documentaries like Dope Sick and Painkillers have laid bare the stark reality of America's opioid crisis. Fentanyl is commonly administered to chronic pain patients through a patch on their skin. But this patch can be abused by people who are looking for a quick high. But we're joined now by an Irishman who has developed a product that aims to make these patches safer for users and less open to abuse. Gareth Sheridan is CEO of Nutriband. Nutriband, and you're very welcome to the programme, Gareth. Before we get into your story, let's talk a bit about fentanyl itself. Many of us have read books or watched shows highlighting the devastating consequences of becoming addicted to a prescription drug like fentanyl. It really is dangerous, isn't it?
It is dangerous, Richard. I mean, I think firstly it's important to understand opiates and the background and to the negative stigma surrounding them at the moment. Opiates for a long time now have been used very effectively to treat severe and chronic pain. However, we have Dope Sick, which is a clear reminder of the ease of these products and the ability to abuse them. We're looking at the patch space. Dope Sick was primarily focused on orals and Oxycontin and those types of products. However, patches make up a vast majority of overdose and hospitalizations as well.
The whole idea behind the patches and the administering the drugs through patches is that it does it in a way that is supposed to be safe, not open to abuse, and if administered correctly and used correctly, a person would not necessarily become addicted to the drug.
That's correct. So the mechanism of a patch is basically a slow release of the opiate into the body to provide pain relief. These types of products are used for patients in car crashes, severe spinal injuries, cancer care, end-of-life care. This is not I have a migraine type of product. Very effective when used correctly. The unfortunate reality is that they're very simple and easy to abuse in their current state.
And one of the problems was that they were overprescribed and too loosely prescribed as well.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, pain is subjective. It's very difficult to understand who's using these products for a purposeful need or just simply to get high. And the ease and simplicity of abusing these products is as simple as cutting it up and putting it in your mouth and chewing it. You'll have people will smoke the insides of a patch. You'll have scenarios where people will use it almost like a tea bag and they'll soak it in an alcohol solution and they'll consume that liquid. Fentanyl is up to 50 times more potent than heroin. So it's very easy to miscalculate what you're trying to do to get that high, and it results in significant deaths and overdoses.
And that potency affects, am I right in saying, even police or emergency workers going into situations where the drug is maybe being manufactured somewhere?
Yeah, correct. So in the States, if a first responder is called to a suspected fentanyl overdose, they will actually arrive at the scene in a hazmat suit because there could be enough fentanyl in the air that could cause the first responders overdose at the scene. So it's a very volatile compound in itself. However, when used correctly, it's second to none for managing these chronic pain scenarios. So we're in a position now where these types of products, unfortunately, are easily abused. They're not safe for prescribers to feel comfortable prescribing them. And the kind of knock-on effect of that is that the pain community who require these types of products don't have access. And then the ease in abusing them is high.
So what are you looking at? What will your product do?
So what we've done is we've developed a product called Aversa, which is a technology that's applicable to any patch on the market today, with the goal of significantly improving the safety profile of that patch. Opiates were the clear focus for us, starting with fentanyl and working our way down the family. We don't necessarily take the mentality that opiates should be eradicated. There is really no alternative treatment for these types of pain patients at the moment. If somebody is reliant on an opiate, they can't be expected to take a Nurofen and have the same type of effect. So it's important to make sure that opiates are still available to the pain community that rely on them. However, focus on making them significantly safer than what's there today.
So how will you make it different?
So if you imagine a fentanyl patch about the size of a credit card, it's a very simple product. Think nicotine patch for opiates. You have a release layer, you have the drug layer in the middle, and then you have a backing layer. That's worn by the patient and provides the pain relief. However, we've gone over the simplicity and ease of abusing these products. So as a company, when we were looking at this and a solution-oriented approach, we looked at all the major routes of abuse, and that was oral or nasal in their approach. And what we done was take a position that was very easy to understand, very simple, but very effective. And we made the patch taste really, really bad. So we use a combination of two ingredients, denatonium benzoate, which is the most bitter substance on the planet, and capsaicin or red pepper extract.
And so one way of abusing the patch was people would actually bite into it.
Correct.
That to get access to the fentanyl at the centre. And a patch would typically last, I'm thinking about the dose of the drug, a patch would last how long? That if somebody was to bite into it, they'd get how many weeks of painkiller in an instant?
Yeah, typically the most common would be one day patches, but there can be 70% residual fentanyl left in a patch even after use. You know, fentanyl, again, to give you an idea of its severity, you know, the table we're sitting at here, a block of fentanyl this size will probably hospitalise everybody in Ireland. It only takes a very small amount to miscalculate how much you really need.
So in that, if it's so addictive and so potent, will making it taste bad be enough to prevent somebody who has an addiction from biting on it and abusing the drug that's there?
Yeah, we're in a position, again, where opiates are a necessary part of pain treatment. There is no alternative now. So they're not going anywhere. The real focus needs to be on making it significantly safer. There is nothing that is abuse-proof. Abuse deterrent is what the FDA and what we're focusing on now. You know, with Aversa, we're in a position where we would be the safest version of this product on the market, in a market that's about $1 billion a year, just in the United States. We think there's an opportunity to cannibalize the market, and as a company, be in a nice niche where we do something very good socially, but also benefit our shareholders.
And that safest part that you referenced there relates to the taste issue to prevent it being bitten.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, what we've done with Aversa, you know, counters a lot of the roots of abuse. And when I say the combination of denatonin and capsaicin is extremely unpleasant, unbearable is probably another suitable word you could use there. It makes it very difficult. You're always going to have one person that can still abuse the patch. But versus a patch that's on the market today, it's 99% safer than what's there. So the goal is to start making a dent in the overdose and hospitalization rates. It will never be eradicated.
If you were to have a large slice of that fentanyl or patch market, it's not as big a market as it was because, rightly so, we've finally seen in the United States a clampdown on the misuse and an overprescription of the drug as well. So how big is that market now?
So 2016, the fentanyl patch market was about $4 billion in the United States. We're about a quarter of that today. So just under $1 billion a year in prescriptions. We're in a position as a company where we think we can revolutionize the safety profile of this product, and we could certainly look at cannibalizing that market as the only version of this product on the market. The important thing to note here as well is that the pain community that are looking for access to this types of products has not reduced by 75% in the same rate prescriptions have. So there's a disconnect between adequate prescribing to the pain community versus 2016. So we certainly think with a safer version of this product where there's not so much of a reluctance to prescribe, you could see that go back to 2016 levels.
Is there a danger though? Because one of the problems was the abuse of the drug, but the other was its over-distribution and over-prescription. Is there a danger that by developing something that allows the medical industry to say, oh no, this one's much more safer, it's a slippery slope when it comes to over-prescription again?
Yeah, I think there has to be kind of a natural balance there, because you can't take a multi-billion dollar pain situation where there's patients that are not getting adequate treatment now. A lot of the overdose rates that we see and a lot of the issues that we see with fentanyl in the news somewhat are caused by the fact that pain patients cannot get adequate access to these drugs. So they'll start buying their fentanyl on the street now instead of getting it in a controlled environment from their prescriber. It's a very complicated issue. You know, there's no one direction you can take it to eradicate opiates entirely, because it is a necessary part of pain treatment. And we're at the forefront of making opiates significantly safer than what's there, because it's not going anywhere. The goal should be, as a pharmaceutical community, to make sure that we do it in the safest way possible.
You're in the process of seeking or finalising FDA approval for the product. Is that right, Carol?
That's correct, yeah. So right now we're targeting Q1 of 2025 to file for approval. We should have a six-month expedited review with a goal of getting this to market at the end of 2025. We think we'll very quickly gain market share just because of the reduced liability associated with the prescription.
And you're ready to manufacture? Have you been manufacturing for the purposes of running trials, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so we've been working on this since our NASDAQ listing in 2021. We were lucky and fortunate enough to partner with a company called Kindeva Drug Delivery, which is formerly 3M Drug Delivery. These are the, you know, the pioneers of the modern day patch. We've taken their FDA-approved fentanyl patch and we're adding our Reversa technology with the goal of jointly taking that to market with them as the manufacturer and us as the marketer. So getting the backing and the understanding from a company like Kindeva really proved what we felt was a good opportunity.
How did you end up developing this in the first place? Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, the idea came, I was in DIT. The idea came in my last year. I was thinking of a thesis to write, couldn't really, you know, focus on something. And, you know, I was very interested in health and, you know, those types of products at the time. And my dad wore a patch. It's a nitroglycerin patch for treating heart medication. And I thought, you know, I was thinking, what else can be used by a patch? I never see patches for much besides nicotine. You know, could patches be used for supplements? Could patches be used for, you know, people that need to take insulin, for example, other people that maybe have an issue with swallowing pills and capsules. And I just got very obsessive with the idea of what you could use a patch for, and decided to write my thesis on that until it got to a point where I felt I was writing more of a business plan, and decided to do my thesis on something else. And in my final year of college, started developing what is the company today. You know, it was naive in a sense at the time. I started working on the company in my final year.
Well, people are often very guarded about business ideas. Were you worried that if you'd latched onto something brilliant in your thesis or your project, somebody might say, oh, I think I'll run with that?
Yeah, that was the naivety, I think. I said, you know what, I think I'm onto something here. I'm gonna pull my thesis because I don't want anyone to read it and steal my idea. If anybody gets wind of this, half of Dublin's going to be starting their own transdermal patch company, and they'll get to it before me. You know, I thought this was the next.
So does that mean you had to write a thesis very quickly afterwards
very
on something
quickly.
Else?
Yeah. So my fourth year of college, my college performance definitely suffered because I was putting all my attention into developing this company. So I did my thesis on, I think it was, you know, corruption in Italian football. You know, something completely irrelevant.
Something from life experience, was it?
Yeah, exactly. I think Juventus had their issues at the time and I was interested in that.
Sounds like you lost a few quid on a bet and decided to go on and look at why that had happened.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, it was just something that I could pull probably from the first page of the newspaper to do my thesis on and then keep focusing on the company. And, you know, it was an interesting year in college because I didn't tell anybody firstly. So the perception of my college performance was that I was a bit of a dosser. I wasn't showing up to classes. I wasn't getting work done. When really I was just spending all of my time working on the business. And I remember doing group projects, you know, four people group projects. I remember doing them on my own because, you know, my friends and peers in there didn't want to do a project with me because they thought I wasn't going to show up to college or do my piece. So it was an interesting year in fourth year, very stressful, but, you know, came out of it with, you know, a company that I had started and something that I went straight into working on.
Lots of people have ideas, something that they think would make a great business idea, but they don't actually do anything about it. Had there been business in your family?
Yeah, I would say, you know, my parents would be quite influential on me. My parents, you know, as I was growing up, they had a couple of news agents. My dad had a painting company. You know, they definitely ingrained in me from an early age that I would want to be my own boss and I would not want to answer to somebody and be kind of controlling my own destiny on a business sense.
Did you do any work in the family business? Were you in the shops or painting or anything?
Yeah. You know, there's one story that I remember when everybody was getting the new Nokia 3310 and I asked my parents, can I get this phone as well? Everyone's getting it. And they said, of course you can. What days do you want to come to work? So, you know, my dad brought me into probably purposely to a very grueling outside paint job in the middle of winter, you know, in Dublin. And I remember, you know,
how long did you last at it before you had the price of the phone?
I think the phone cost me about 4 days painting in the freezing cold. And at the end of it, I think I remember my dad saying that I turned to him and said, you know, do you do this every day? And he said, yeah, of course I do. And this is, you know, this is why you need to be your own boss, so you don't answer to someone like me going forward. And I think that kind of stuck with me. You know, I graduated college, paintbrush in one hand and degree in the other, and started my own company. So that's.
And you moved to Salt Lake City.
Yeah. So early on, I was working with a company that was based out of Salt Lake that liked the idea, started traveling back and forth. You know, that kind of grew legs. I always saw America as the destination. If this was going to be a big company and something I wanted to turn it into, that had to be the destination. The US is 50% of the global market for the types of products we're talking about. And then going back and forth on my travels, I ended up meeting my now wife, Heidi, on St. Patrick's Day in a bar, and the rest is kind of history there. So Salt Lake is home right now.
And you've raised the money to bring the company to this point. You've raised several million. You had a recent fundraising this year as well.
Yeah, so we listed on the NASDAQ in October of 21. We raised $6.6 million. That was at about a $40 million valuation. That really got us started in the development of Aversa. We've done some smaller rounds along the way, but our recent round, we raised $8.4 million from existing shareholders. So that was a big win for us, not to have to go back and, you know, hand out the money basket to the Wall Street guys and go into those sort of deals that, you know, I find very unfavorable. So the backing of existing shareholders was a huge show of confidence, I think, with how close we are to this Aversa product.
But trying to build any product that requires FDA approval from scratch is a long, difficult process. But as you describe it to me, would a shortcut have been to say, I've got this great idea for making these patches more difficult for people to abuse, which would make them safer, which might allow things to improve for people. I license my technology to someone who already makes the patches rather than building the whole thing from scratch and doing everything yourselves.
I think, you know, in certain circumstances, yes. That's somewhat built into the strategy we have in terms of international, you know, partnerships will be based most likely off licensing agreements. We're focusing on the US market to take that product to market. I think the benefit that we have is that we're not developing a brand new drug. We're taking an existing approved drug and just improving upon that. So the timeline and costs involved is not what you see in typical drug development, but the upside in terms of market share is. So focusing on the US market and then licensing opportunities internationally is what we're doing now. We're patented in 45 countries. We cover all major markets with, at the moment, nobody coming up behind us to do the same thing. So we think we could be the sole name in this space in the near term.
Must be very difficult to get FDA approval, time consuming, expensive.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, nothing's guaranteed with the FDA. It's expensive. That's definitely correct. But we've hit all of our targets since our listing.
And if it goes well, are you looking at other applications outside of the opioid fentanyl area, other types of patches?
Yeah, so we're Aversa as a platform, it can be applied to any patch on the market. So we're going to prove the model with fentanyl, improve the safety profile there, and then work our way down other easily abused patches. So buprenorphine is another example. Methylphenidate, which is an ADHD drug, is commonly abused as well. But in the long term, you know, Nutriband is not a sole Aversa company. I mean, the company's kind of model is using transdermal technology to improve patient outcome, improve much more beyond just safety in certain products. So something that we have our eyes focused on is looking at the diabetes market as well, where we have, you know, good, very early stage data to show that we are onto something, perhaps with a patch that could replace injectables for insulin and other diabetic treatments. So
it's potentially a huge market. You could end up making a lot of money, Gareth. Have you managed to hold on to a lot of the shareholding in the business, having raised that money?
Yeah, I think that's been very important to me as well, that you commonly see a company will list on NASDAQ, they'll raise money, they'll burn through it, raise money, burn through it. You know, we've run the company very tightly since our NASDAQ listing, which is not typically seen again. I mean, we listed on the NASDAQ, nobody was going out buying Ferraris the next day. This was a very common sense approach. And the NASDAQ was a stepping stone to the end goal, not the end goal. So being very careful with the type of money we brought in has been important. You know, I've been able to retain almost 20% of the company that's now NASDAQ listed, which is quite significant for a public company, particularly in the US. So this is something that's not a quick money grab type thing. I think there's a real opportunity for this to be a generational company.
So you're hopeful 2025 is going to be a big year for the business. Gareth Sheridan, founder of Nutriband, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.